When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Today on The Grave Talks, Engineering for the Paranormal, a conversation with Rob Walczak. What do you get when you mix childhood ghost encounters with a degree in engineering? You get Rob Walczak. Rob was raised in a haunted house in Michigan, and his early fascination with things that go bump in the night didn't send him running. It sent him inventing. Today, he's at the helm of Ghost Gear, a company responsible for some of the most cutting-edge ghost hunting tools on the market. From the Epic Box to the Piccolo EMF Music Box, Rob isn't just building gadgets, he's revolutionizing how we connect with the afterlife. And today, Rob is on location at the Haunted Mullins Home in Morristown, Tennessee. Today on The Grave Talks is spirited chat, pun absolutely intended, with Rob as we explore his journey, his inventions, and his mission to bring science to the supernatural. I kind of wanted to ask you a little before we kind of dive into your background and where you're at today. Obviously, you were interested in the paranormal to an extent that you were like, I've got some good ideas for some better equipment. My brain is not like that. I am not smart enough. But you have an engineering background, and you've come up with a couple really cool devices.
Yeah. So my background is I grew up in a haunted house there in Michigan. It was a small little bungalow type house, and there weren't enough bedrooms for all of us siblings. So my dad had a second story built onto it. And it was after that second story was built, things got really weird. So my sister would see a little boy float into a room with no legs. My dad would see shadow people in the bedroom crawling on the floor. It was interesting for me. I say they, because I've seen two different ones. They came to me alien graves. So I remember waking up. It was one weekend and I woke up in the middle of the night and looked over, and there was this like alien gray ghost. It was glowing like a glow in the dark sticker, but it wasn't giving off light, but it was that's the best way I can describe it. It's like a glow in the dark sticker. And it looked at me, and I, you know, kind of freaked out, looked at it, and it slid sideways like it was on a monorail into the wall. Mm-mm. And then later I saw another gray like Alien, but this one wasn't ghostly, it was more fleshy, come out of that wall. So I'm looking back at it and I'm thinking that might have been the portal. And it came out of the wall and interacted with me that way. So I don't
Old were you then?
At that time, I was an early teen, maybe a preteen. So around the 12 to 14-ish. I'm 50 now, so you're making me go way back. I was around the 12 to 14-ish age.
You know what's interesting? Like when it happens when you're that age, had you had any experience before? Because, of course, you know, you've heard of ghosts and things like that and probably were interested in it. But if you've never had the experience in that, especially you were living in that house, I don't even know how you would, when something like that happens, where do you even put that information? And do you go run and tell your parents? And how did you handle it and process it?
I ran out of the room. And I know when the fleshy alien gray came out, when I was able to leave and left, I went down the street to my best friend's house and I knocked on the door, woke him up. You know, we didn't have cell phones back then, but beat on his window, woke him up, and I spent the night there at that house. But yeah, there were several times because things happened even when I got older, where I just would leave the house. I'm like, there's no way I would go stay at a friend's house. There was one instance I'm thinking of right now when I was older. I had graduated high school, so I was 19 or 20, and my parents had left. They went down to Tennessee. That's where my dad was going to retire, down in Tennessee, and they were looking for a home to buy down there. And they had the dogs with them. I'm sitting in the living room of the house in Michigan and watching TV, and I can see through the hallway that leads to the stairs. And I see the two dogs take off running towards the stairs, and they're not allowed upstairs. So I had to go get them. Well, halfway up the stairs is when it dawned on me that the dogs were with mom and dad. What the heck did I just see? Right. So those were a lot of the strange things that we would witness in that house.
Did you have, you know, when I was a kid and we lived in a house that was haunted, and it was years later, you know, sitting around and talking about it, because it's kind of traumatizing at the time. And do you really want to talk about it? Because when you talk about it, it becomes even more real.
Yeah.
Is that kind of, as adults, did you talk with your siblings about it and realize you had several experiences that you hadn't shared that they had also experienced?
Yes. So I learned later that my sister, she had a friend over, and she was in high school at this time. So she had a friend over, and I think they were getting ready to go out for the night, go to a party or something, whatever. And her friend looked through the mirror and could see out the window. Now, my sister's room was on the second floor. She saw that little boy looking in from outside.
Ooh.
She screamed. My sister turned and looked directly out the window and saw him. They both screamed. And that's when we all came running up there because we were trying to figure out what was going on, why they were both screaming, right? And, you know, they told us, or they told my mom what had happened, but my mom had never really shared everything that I told her or my sister had told her with each other. So we didn't get a lot of like cross contamination, in that realm. Like, you know, here recently, as we've gotten older, I've told my sister about the aliens that I had seen. Secretly, I had gotten involved with MUFON because I saw the aliens and I'm thinking, you know, abduction, right? Not necessarily ghosts, but when we moved out of that house, I never had that experience again. So it kind of, I don't know if it was really an abduction situation because they didn't follow me, right? It all stayed with that house.
It has to all be tied to adding on that second floor and disturbing everything.
Right.
I'm going to guess.
You know, I do recall when the contractors were up there building the second floor, they would complain to my parents that the kids were up there messing with them. Now, we never climbed the ladder. We were really young at that time. We never climbed the ladder to get up there, and it didn't look like a fun place to be. So, kid, you know, I didn't want to go up there as a kid, but they would blame us for stuff. And, you know, as a kid, I took that personally. I was like, I wasn't up there, Mom. I will, you know. But later, now that I look back at it, and I'm like, that may have been activity picking up while they were up there building that second floor, and they just thought it was us kids.
Mm-hmm. And I think what happened with you is what happens to so many people when they grow up in a situation like that. I think it could go one of two ways. Either you're terrified of it and want nothing to do with it and you run from it for the rest of your lives, or right. you're fascinated by it. And I actually, and it might just be the nature of this show, obviously I talk to the people who are fascinated by it, but I think so many of us are drawn to it and we're kind of fascinated. I'm still kind of scared of it. I don't want to live in a house where I hear those things and experience those things again, but I'm also drawn to it. And right. that's you as well. You're definitely drawn to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, just in the family alone on my mom's side, folklore was kind of a big thing in the stories. My mom can tell fantastic ghost stories. She's just a very good storyteller. And she's got a lot of stories from her youth that she experienced herself living in Kentucky, you know, paranormal like stories. So that's always kind of been, you know, around me. So I haven't been afraid of it. I mean, I don't want to go through it, like you said, right? To wake up and stare at something looking back at you that's not human right. is not an enjoyable situation. No. But at the same time, like you said, we kind of crave it, you know, those stories. We love to hear those stories and watch those kind of movies. So that, you know, that is really what led into, for me, Ghost Gear. You know, I went on in life and went to college and became an engineer and for a while got away from ghost hunting. Well, I wasn't really a ghost. I did do residential stuff because back then we didn't really have an internet back then, but there, you know, haunted locations weren't a thing. Right. So, and then when I got, after I got my degree and I kind of started tinkering with devices, that's what led up into Ghost Gear. So a lot of my background with the hauntings and the, you know, my curiosity, very curious person, right? You know, in engineering, I'm curious about how things work and how to make things, take them apart, you know, the classical, take it apart, figure out how it works. And I'm also curious about the paranormal.
See, and my brain is so not like that. Rob, if I took something apart, I would never in a million years get it back together. I thank God for YouTube tutorials every day. Like, is there a YouTube tutorial on that? Then I can do it. So at some point you did start doing paranormal investigations, and that had to have been what got you thinking about the gear. You know, the gear has changed so much over the years. So maybe when you first started out, they didn't have what you wanted. And maybe that got you thinking about what you could create on your own.
Yeah. So what I started making, you know, was my own gear for my own investigations. And a lot of it was for, it lent itself to the scientific method. And, you know, I say that and I can see people cringing when they hear me say that, but I would make like data loggers, right? And I would have a theory and I would want to test that theory. So I would make a device that would help me test that theory. And that's where a lot of my devices, you know, came from. And, you know, some of them worked fantastic. Some of them were duds. So I shelved the duds and, you know, sometimes the duds got reworked and for a different theory and they would work there as well. And then I started getting requests from other people to make them equipment. And that's what kind of sent me down that rabbit hole.
Is it kind of a full-time thing for you at this point? Are you still kind of doing that?
I don't want it to be, but it is. And I say that because I have a full-time job. And
oh, you're busy.
This was like a, you know, thing, something I did on the side. But it's consuming a lot of my time. And I think I'm letting it just because I'm curious about it. And, you know, I'm passionate about it. And I believe that there are things that happen that we can't explain. And I want to be able to explain those. I guess I'm not a normal engineer in that sense, because most engineers don't like anomalies, right? You can't build a bridge based on anomalies, right? You want that bridge to be safe and secure. And you want to use hard facts and numbers when you build that bridge. But scientists and physicists, they kind of run towards anomalies. They love anomalies, right? That's because that's where they find answers in anomalies. And I'm in that kind of that weird I guess, place between engineering and kind of scientist mind, right? Because I am an engineer, but I also run towards the anomalies.
Because especially with your childhood and knowing that things happened and then doing investigations at various locations, I'm sure you've encountered things over the years that you cannot explain. So right. My guess is the way your brain works is like, I want to explain this.
Yeah.
And so right. I need to get the data to explain it. When you first started doing investigations and maybe EVPs or whatever it was that really got your brain thinking how you could expand on something, what were kind of the first things that you thought, I'd like to figure this out?
One of the first things, I wanted to find out what frequency they operate at.
Oh, that's because interesting.
I thought if I could find out what frequency they're operating at, you could design a device and hone in on that frequency, right? So EVPs are one, like you mentioned. You know, at what frequency are they, let's say they're broadcasting, what frequency are they broadcasting at? And could we make a device that would, you know, hone in on that frequency to be able to pick them up easier? You know, maybe that's what the Panasonic DDR60 does. You know, maybe that's why everyone thinks that one's so great. I don't know, but you know, those are some of the thoughts that I have. And recently my mind has been moving into more of this. Maybe they're not ghosts like we think. Maybe they're interdimensional beings. And that's why they have physical properties, meaning they can scratch us, walk, open doors, touch things. And they're just not ethereal like we think of a ghost or a spirit. So that now coming up with a device to prove that one's difficult.
Yeah, because my sister and I have had some really deep conversations on our other show, Real Ghost Stories, about how can things physically be moved? Like, you know, when you put something right there, how does something come along that's unseen and mysteriously move it to another location of the house or maybe never to be found again, which is also right the case sometimes? Or how do you hear the footsteps at night? What's creating that? And in fact, we were just talking about that before we started this. You're in a location right now that's a new location that's just been opened up for investigations. And you're in Tennessee at the Mullins home in Morristown, Tennessee.
That's right. Yep.
And you were just experiencing footsteps all night long.
Yeah. So, yeah, we got here last night and we set up our beds for the night. And I took one room and my friend took another room. And I'm listening to footsteps between the two doors, you know, down the hallway. And I thought, well, maybe it was Travis. He got up and went to the restroom. And I asked him this morning. He said, nope, that wasn't me. And I heard those footsteps too. He said, they walked between both of our doors. I said, yep, they did. That's what I heard. So, yeah, it's like, well, if it's a ghost and it can go through walls and through doors, it has no physical boundaries, then how does it also make footsteps?
Right.
So
because footsteps would be created by mass, you know, you'd have to have some mass to you to create the sound. And then I find it interesting, too, when two people, you're in two separate rooms and you heard the same thing.
Right.
You know, because you could say, oh, it was my imagination. Don't know what that was.
Mm-hmm.
But he confirmed it.
Yeah, right. And the interesting thing is this location is known for heavy footsteps. So one of the contractors he's also an owner, but he does a lot of the work here. He spent the night one night and was woken up to the sounds of the front door being kicked in. So he's armed. He went down with his pistol. And the front door was fine. There was nothing wrong with the front door. And immediately behind him, he heard these heavy footsteps. So he took chase to these footsteps and he followed them around the house, up the stairs and into the back bedroom where they stopped. And he said there was no one in the house.
And he
so
with
here's
his,
this guy with a pistol chasing a ghost throughout the house.
And he could have been, you know, in his brain at that time, he's chasing an intruder.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. But he said he was only about 3 or 4 feet behind where he perceived the sound of the footsteps coming from.
Wow.
And there was nothing there.
Now, this location, when they first bought it, and I looked at it on the internet, and honestly, it does look like it's haunted. And I know that's judging, but you know, I always say there's just those places that you drive by and you go, whoa, that house is haunted. And we all do it. And I think anyone would drive by that house and go, haunted. But so they bought it not knowing that it was a haunted location, correct?
No, they bought it as an investment property. They knew it had to be fixed up. So it sat empty for 12 years. The lady who owned it last passed away in the house. And then it just sat empty for 12 years and they purchased it. And the intent was to fix it up and rent it out as a rental property. And it was during the renovations that they started, you know, witnessing a lot of the footsteps, the voices, the murmuring, you know, a lot of strange things, lights being turned on, you know, things are off in some cases. And in fact, the fellow that's doing all the work, he doesn't believe in ghosts. And he, in fact, so I came out a year ago to investigate the house when the owners contacted me and they said, we kind of want to find out if something's really going on. So I came out here with a friend of mine. He's an author, Alan Cornelison, and we investigated the house and we found it to be very active. And I think it was because nobody came in here before to talk to them, right? So we were the first to address them by name. And so they were very talkative. They seemed very inquisitive with our devices. Interestingly, they would pick like one device a night and just mess with it all night long. And then the next day next night, we investigated it for 7 nights. They would pick a different device and mess with it all night long, you know, and then eventually after a couple of days, they were able to play with all the devices. So now we're back. They've decided to open it up for investigations. They just kind of want to see how that pans out. So tomorrow night is the first night. We're calling it the grand opening, and I'm helping them lead that. So we're going to have some folks out for our first overnight public investigation, and then it will be open, you know, for investigators to rent it out for the night and come investigate.
Now, with the investigation that you've done, and maybe you've dived into the history of the house a little bit, any ideas what you're dealing with, or do you think it's the people who lived there prior? I mean,
our first investigation, the spirits seemed to really like communicating through a spirit box, and they did very well. So we know there are 7 people that passed away in the house over the years.
Interesting.
We started addressing them by names. And the very last woman to pass away in the house is Robbie Davis. She passed away in 2010. And when we got to her name, that's when things got really strange. The Estes method that we were going through when Alan was under the Estes method, he started calling her very filthy names. And then we learned through questioning the spirit through the Estes method that she did something and did not keep her end of the agreement. And this spirit entity that was coming through was very, very upset with her. So we don't know if, I don't know, did she do a seance, didn't close it properly? Did she make a deal with something and didn't keep her end of the bargain? Did she trap a spirit here and it's mad at her? We don't know. And that's what I would like to find out in these next coming days when we do our investigation.
Oh, you have to keep me posted on this. This is like a movie and I need to know how the movie ends. Because it's very fascinating, because you wonder too, maybe there was someone in life who might have taken some money from, might have swindled in some way, and this person's pissed.
We know that her husband passed away before she moved into the house. She lived in North Carolina, and he passed away in North Carolina. And then when her mom and dad owned the house, and they eventually passed away, she got the house in a will, and she moved into the house. And this is pure speculation by me. I think maybe she tried a seance to contact her husband, her late husband, and either messed it up somehow, or trapped a spirit here, or maybe she didn't reach her husband. And then she decided, well, I'm not going to keep my end of the bargain if you're not going to provide me with my, you know, husband to talk to. So that's kind of where my mind goes, you know, with some of this stuff. So that's where, you know, my questioning is going to be for tonight and tomorrow night when we do the investigation.
How many people do you have joining you?
We are going to have 12 people tomorrow. And tonight, it's just going to be Travis and I. We're just going to investigate ourselves. I'm going to try to get some answers to those questions. And then, like always, you end up with more questions. So we'll continue those questions in tomorrow's 12-person overnight investigation.
I'm going to be bugging you in a few days. And if we need to do a part two, a little follow-up thing about this, that would be so interesting. You've got to keep me posted on this.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Because in this situation, and I think it is interesting, sometimes paranormal investigative groups don't really communicate with each other. Other times they do. I think it would be interesting to talk to someone who's investigated it before. But there isn't, you don't have that.
Right. Yeah. So I do have two fantastic historians on the case, Alita Kinley and Tori. They have dug in and they have found so much fascinating history. So the property itself was part of a Civil War skirmish on the property. There's a train track that runs along the back of the property, and that train track basically divided the two factions. And so that means on this property where this house set, a Civil War battle took place, a skirmish. So we know that that's history. Within the property was then owned by a Civil War Major Gammon, who eventually took his own life on the property. And then the house was built. And then when the house was built, Stanley Mullins, which is why we named the house the Mullins House, he passed away from pneumonia just a year after moving into the house. And then ever since then, men have been, well, dying in the house at a higher rate than you would expect. And then finally at the end, Robbie Davis passed away. She was an older woman. She passed away of just natural causes. But the men would pass away from freak accidents, blood poisoning, you know, strange things like that.
Now, when you do investigations over the years, are there some pieces of equipment, not talking about the ones that you have developed, I want to talk about them separately, but are there things that you like to use as go-to, like you were talking about the Estes method, are there things that you like that really do help you with your investigations?
Yeah. So getting into my nerdy engineering side, there's a device out there that I really like. It's called the Maripos. It's made by Jim Sigala, and it is a data logger that logs all kinds of information, including gamma radiation. Right. So what he's finding out, and you can buy these, and I've got one. They're expensive, but and they log data and they go up to a website and you can look at the data that it's logging. So that I think that's fascinating. So what we have found is, and this gets really kind of scary in a way, is that gamma radiation does tick up in haunted locations. He has done studies where he has taken his device to log data at a seance, and he has had to stop the seance because the gamma radiation has gotten too high and he was worried about the people there. And when they stop the seance, it drops down to a safer level.
So that's
one of my favorite devices for data logging, for just communicating with spirits. I like the Estes because, you know, the person isn't front loaded with the questions. They don't know what's being asked. And in fact, one of my favorite things is a double Estes. So I'll have two people back to back doing the Estes while I'm asking questions. And what's interesting is many, many times you'll get spirits start talking to each other through this double Estes method and arguing with one another. And you kind of just sit back and stop asking questions and you kind of eavesdrop in on their conversation. But that's one of my other favorite things to do.
I do find the Estes method fascinating because they can't hear anything. You know, they're just information's coming in. They're just saying things.
Right.
And I think it's so interesting that, especially putting two people in it.
Yeah.
And you're just listening to that.
My theories on the two people, it's like, why do the spirits need the Estes method to communicate with one another? And then I'm thinking, are they on two different planes? Do they not even know? Can they not see each other and communicate with each other? And maybe through the Estes method, they're able to talk to one another. And that's when they start arguing. I've seen it so many times where they'll argue with one another. At certain locations.
And I've thought about that before too. If you're at a haunted location, say there's 10 spirits, do they know each other? Do they interact at all? Are they aware that the other is even there? I don't know. That's what's interesting. I would love to, at some point in my lifetime, somebody go, here's the answer to that. I found it. And that wraps up part one of our conversation with Rob Walczak. For more information, visit his website at ghostgeartech.com. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, everything commercial free, you can become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts where you can try it for 3 days free, or you could also sign up at patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you very much for listening.